We interrupt this broadcast with some important news.
Let's rewind and check out the biggest news stories from this week. It's time for Taiwan This Week.
Good evening and welcome to Taiwan This Week with me, your host, Gavin Phipps. And I'm joined in the studio this evening by our regular commentator, Brian Hugh.
Thanks for having me.
And by Dimitri Buras from TVBS News.
Hi there.
And we'll begin this week with the Cabinet on Thursday approving an anti-fraud package seeking heavier punishments for individuals or groups convicted of, well, fraud. Under the proposed legislation and amendments, individuals convicted of fraudulent acts where the gains exceed 10 million NT will face a prison sentence of between 3 and 10 years. Fraud committed by a group of three or more individuals under the guise of a government agency or official or via broadcasting channels or the internet will still receive a prison sentence of between 1 and 7 years, but an additional fine has been raised. The proposal includes provisions for reducing or exempting punishment for fraud perpetrators who surrender themselves and assist law enforcement in apprehending the main culprit or culprits and in seizing illegal gains. And it also seeks to codify the use of certain crime investigative tools by law enforcement agencies, such as the global positioning system for tracking suspects and thermal imaging cameras, as long as there is prior authorization from a court. Meanwhile, the Cabinet also approved an anti-fraud package mandating that multinational digital platforms offering advertising services must assist in identifying, reporting and removing fraudulent content or risk hefty fines and even service suspensions. The new legislation and amendment proposals will require large digital services to appoint a legal representative in Taiwan to ensure compliance with local regulations. Those platforms will be obligated to remove or restrict access to fraudulent advertisements or messages, suspend services for users suspected of fraud, and report relevant illegal activities to the authorities. They will also need to verify and disclose the identity of those who wish to run advertisements using their services and label advertisements with deepfake or AI-generated content. Now, the deputy head of the Administration for Digital Industries says failure to comply with those regulations will result in a maximum fine of 25 million NT or the suspension of services in Taiwan. Now, currently, platforms such as Google and Meta will take down fraudulent advertisements on receiving reports from government agencies, but they are not accountable for any legal content. Now, all of those proposals regarding fraud are now being sent to the Legislative Yuan for review and approval. So, Brian, I mean, fraud as in the people that telephone you type of fraud, and fraud as in Google advertising something that's fraudulent there.
Yeah, absolutely. And so this works on a few levels, targeting the people perpetrating fraud, but also making platforms responsible for taking down such content. And so this has been a challenge in the past. Particularly now, I mean, we see with telephones and text messages and online, there's just much scams going around, particularly targeting the elderly, financial scams, various attempts to get your information. There's a lot of calls going around, just calls from unclear numbers. And then there have been a lot of efforts to crack down on this. Whether strengthening the punishments is enough to deter fraud, though, is a question, particularly when there are, for example, telecom fraud rings that are actually operating outside of Taiwan. And then that does require cross-border cooperation between Taiwan and usually the Southeast Asian country in which a fraud ring is operating. Sometimes Taiwanese that are abroad or Chinese that are there targeting Taiwan in these groups, and some of these people are actually held without against their will actually to be part of these rings. And as for the attempt to get platforms to really regulate fraud, this has been a challenge because of the fact that the smaller platforms have a lot of trouble with this. If you're an internet forum, if you're PTT, for example, or Bahamut, the gaming forum, you don't actually have a lot of resources in order to look into all these different cases. And this is similar to the measures attempted to crack down on disinformation with these platforms, that smaller platforms that are run by regular people and not these large and powerful platforms, a lot of money and staff, it's very hard for them. And so it looks like this is targeting mostly the larger platforms that do have the capacity to do this. But will they actually comply is a question. And I think it's a problem with regards to these large platforms anywhere in the world, that there is rising amounts of fake accounts and frauds and scams and et cetera.
Well, I agree. I agree with the need for a shift towards a zero tolerance policy on fraud with the new presidency on the horizon. I also agree that these stricter penalties could help protect the public by targeting the small-time groups. But I'm less confident about these measures' ability to dismantle organized criminal groups that thrive on people's misery. So yes, the no parole policy for repeat offenders could be a game changer in deterring crime, but we have been promising leniency for cooperative criminals for years without a boost in arrest. So the tech upgrades will maybe show a modern approach to law enforcement, but it's too early to announce and to understand whether they could redefine justice in Taiwan.
And Dimitri, I mean, you think if Google run an advertisement that falls foul of the laws, do you think it's going to be a long court case?
Yeah, but it's not Google running the advertisement. It's the people behind running that advertisement. So I agree that with the importance of a collaborative defense strategy, but I think that incorporating maybe other actors like media and NGOs in setting like a fraud definition, especially for misinformation, would further enhance the transparency and the fairness of regulations. This isn't merely about regulation. It's about cultivating a broad-based consensus of what is misleading content really is. Involving these groups promises a more balanced approach to online security, ensuring that standards reflect the diverse viewpoints. So it's a multi-stakeholder involvement, and which is vital for creating a robust defense against digital misinformation.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I think the question is, these larger groups that are harder to crack down on, as I mentioned, some of them are actually not in Taiwan, but then the smaller groups that may be operating in Taiwan, these measures may be more effective for. But I think it's a question in terms of the ability of governments to regulate platforms, and that's true of Taiwan or anywhere else in the world. It's interesting, too, the way in which fraud dovetails with, let's say, misinformation and disinformation, because arguably fraud is a form of disinformation in the sense of you're trying to trick somebody into a scam and you're feeding them false information. And sometimes you are actually drawing on what is actually true in the news to form this narrative to trick people. I think the interesting thing is that a lot of the fraud that does occur is not occurring through these newer online platforms such as Facebook or even Google and et cetera. A lot is actually occurring by way of telecom fraud through telephones. And there's another thing, actually, with disinformation, a lot of focus predominantly on social media. But then how do you target these telephone-based scams? And that is actually often operating through telecom providers. And there have been some attempts, for example, blocking numbers with certain codes that are attempting to come off as though they are in Taiwan, well, they may not be. But it's still a challenge, I think, there.
And Brian, of course, they introduced that thing last year where if you get a phone call from an international number,
yes,
it warns you that this is not a Taiwan number before you even answer the phone.
Yes, that's right, which is actually often very disconcerting for international callers who wonder then why there's a delay and has it gotten through. So there is that. It's a question. I do think that many people pick up the phone and don't actually pay attention. And there are apps now that allow for blocking suspicious numbers that are found to be guilty of calling many times and spamming. But you also do have the various attempts in which someone calls you and immediately hangs up. You call back and it's a blank number. That's also on the rise. And so I think actually that's one of the major issues. A lot is occurring through phone calls. But it is interesting to me now in the past few years, there's much more discussion of fraud. It actually became a political issue in the last election. And I think that's relatively new. Dealing with this as a social issue because fraud has grown to such an extent in Taiwan that your line fills up every day with fraud messages, that there is a call on governments to take offices, and political parties themselves will fight about what they think is the best policy to do this as well.
Well, the announcement ahead of an international phone call is, I think, it's pretty annoying. Imagine those people who work in international companies and throughout the day receive those foreign phone calls and have to listen to that announcement like 20, 30 times a day. I don't see the point. I see the good intentions always, yes, but it's a kind of reminder that we should be very careful. But we should also remember that these frauds do not happen not anymore just on Facebook, on those major platforms. It's always now in a one-by-one conversation, in a private conversation. And it's going to be extremely hard for authorities to fight against these new scam schemes because it's just two people, you and the scammer. And it's very easy to get they use new technologies like AI just to cheat you out of the little money you have.
And of course, Brian, like you mentioned telephones. I mean, I've got a few of these messages pretending to be from my bank, basically, yeah? Telling me that, oh, you've got to log on to this, go to this website and fill in your information. Well, they've obviously got my phone number from somewhere.
Yeah, so this is actually one of the interesting things, too. So fraud, in this sense, is a very multi-layered problem that hits out a lot of different aspects that are problematic in Taiwan. For example, very poor data security across the board. S-Leet, for example, is infamous for this. And so you go buy a book at S-Leet, and the data leaks, and then they have your number information and maybe what book you bought. And in the past, this actually led to, for example, a call from China in which a person was then like, well, why did you buy this problematic book? That's one example. I mean, that was a kind of attempt at intimidation for the election. That's also how fraud works. And so the data practices in Taiwan, that is in need of improvement. And so that makes it easier for them to actually come off as real or authentic, particularly targeting groups like the elderly or very young people. And that, I think, is the problem, actually, that it goes after these vulnerable groups that can be tricked into this. Or maybe they just don't have time to check and see, is this actually the email from whatever company that you might have actually gotten? And they post to be customer service or your bank or what have you.
And Dimitri, of course, this leads down to the fact that how do they get your number? Are telecom companies, are branches of telecom company outlets selling numbers to companies?
Well, legally, they cannot do that. They cannot sell your personal information. But some crooks within those companies who managed to access those data, they started selling them. And so companies might also have now to look into better ways to protect the data, the information they collect from their users, and protect these information against their own employees. So it's a multilateral issue. Whether it's the government, whether it's private companies, and even users, maybe we should also spend more time in training users and asking themselves about, is this the real person? Am I talking to a real person? Is this my a family member that is actually calling me? So we need to train also people to react and asking themselves the right questions.
Which, of course, Brian, brings us to AI.
Yeah, that's a danger, actually, that AI can get more sophisticated at this. For example, maybe you can find, if you automate this process, in theory, you could find someone's vocal samples online somewhere of maybe a relative, and then it makes it even harder to check if it's real or not. It's also interesting, too, because some of the fraud that does already exist, even pre-AI, was using packages of online audio files that were often scripted, and so trying to pose as somebody. There have been, for example, case of fraud in which you get called up by somebody and it sounds like a real person actually on the other end, but it's actually a series of audio files, and then depending on how you respond, they play another one, and etc. So it's actually not a new problem, but AI does make it potentially more dangerous. And I think particularly the world is dealing with the challenge of AI and the ability to then produce this kind of information used for fraud or disinformation or misinformation at scale. And so I think Taiwan, does it have solutions? I'm not too sure. The world is all dealing with right now, and it's kind of new territory.
Oh, we have the Ministry of Digital Affairs, though.
That's right. And that is a question, though, because historically, actually, it's not as focused on such issues. So then this deals with other government stakeholders, particularly law enforcement.
Moving on now, the KMT this week submitted a proposal which seeks to invite President-elect Lai Ching-te to make what will be Taiwan's first State of the Nation address at the Legislative Yuan following his May 20th inauguration. Now, according to KMT Caucus Secretary-General Hong Meng Kai, Lai needs to explain and clarify his planned policies with lawmakers, and the proposal for him to address lawmakers adheres to Article 15-2 of the Act on Exercising Legislative Yuan Powers. Now, the Taiwan People's Party has also submitted a similar proposal on the issue, and they're both being debated today in the Legislative Yuan. Now, the KMT is calling on the DPP not to block the proposal, and Legislative Speaker Han Kuo-yu says he hopes both sides can agree on the issue. The DPP has said Lai is open to the idea of making a State of the Nation address, but several issues still need to be negotiated. And the main issue there is whether Lai will take questions from individual lawmakers after giving his address, Dimitri. So, should there be a State of the Nation address? Should Lai go and address the lawmakers in person? And if so, should he field questions from individual lawmakers?
Well, I don't think so. I think there is a real concern that it might spark more conflict in the Legislative Yuan. Now, regular sessions, typically about policy, have too often turned into battlegrounds of intense political fighting already. So including a Q&A session with the president, I think, could increase tensions, echoing past clashes in the legislature that made national news and international news. So while these addresses aim for transparency, they frequently become tinderboxes disrupting the flow of conversation. So history warns us to be careful in Taiwan, as disturbances tend to eclipse the positive intention of these gatherings. So I see this upcoming address as possibly making political divisions worse, not better.
Maybe Han Guo Yu will just have to do his job to make sure there's no argy-bargy.
Well, yeah, that's it. I think he will try his best.
Yeah, that's a Britishism I don't understand. But that aside, actually, it's a double-edged sword in that sense. There are two sides to the issue, because I do agree that's necessary for transparency or more transparency from government. Tsai Ing-wen, for example, notoriously refused to hold press conferences and spent many years not doing that, as was criticized by media. But then with regards to statements by Lai, then this would actually be used potentially for ammunition by China, and it would stir partisan conflict. The KMT has increasingly called for having DPP lawmakers in these high positions, president and premier, reporting to the legislature, delivering a State of the Nation address or something similar. But in terms of Q&A, it's possible they would just be looking for a gotcha, which could have bad implications for Taiwan if it does touch on cross-strait issues, particularly trying to push Lai on, say, the 1999 consensus, he misspeaks or something of that sort, and then it creates another kind of hullabaloo around politics. The kind of pushback then one saw, for example, when Lai had a gaffe when he said he wanted to visit the White House, for example. So there's that. And there's also possibly that the KMT would actually boycott an address, similar to what happened when Chen Jieren, the premier, did speak at the legislature. Or maybe they might throw things at him. It really depends. And so if there's a civility there, maybe it's a good idea, but there's also the possibility that it would have dangerous outcomes. And regardless of what happens, it would be used for partisan infighting, as is such the case with Taiwanese political culture more broadly.
Could he do it via Zoom, though, Brian? He'll be in the presidential building and they can be in the legislative UN.
Yeah, it's possible, though. I kind of wondered what's the point. But in that sense, actually, this is another reason I think that the split between premier and president is actually somewhat useful, in that the premier is the one that can be called on to give an address and take the blows for the president, while the president, as the person that ultimately sets and arbitrates policy, particularly regarding sensitive issues like cross-strait relations, can stay a bit out of the fray. So that is quite interesting, actually.
And Dimitri, Brian raised an interesting point there with Tsai Ing-wen refusing to have press conferences. Do you think Lai Ching-te will have press conferences? Because we all know that Xiaobi Kim will have press conferences.
Yes, but I don't think it's right. President Tsai Ing-wen loves to talk to the media, but she doesn't want to talk to the local media because they like to control the narrative. So they want to have those one-on-one interaction with the media, feeding them with their narrative about Taiwan. And usually foreign media don't like to challenge them on those specific details about Taiwan history and the like. So they like to control the narrative. So at the Legislative UN, the concern would be to control the narrative. Now, maybe some people don't know, but in Taiwan, when you go to a press conference, you have to often send your questions in advance. So if you plan to attend a major press conference with a VIP, they usually ask you to send the questions in advance so that they can control the narrative. At the Legislative UN, it's very unlikely that the legislator would just say in advance the tough questions they're going to ask the president. So that's why I'm very concerned that this would turn out into something pretty ugly and funny for the international media.
I'm not sure I agree, because I think Q&A in press conferences and in the legislature always turns into kind of looking for gotcha moments. And so then often at times at a press conference, you do have then the question that's not about the issue at hand, for example, but then about a scandal that the that person that's talking is involved in, which has nothing to do with what the press conference is about. But it is the case that with VIPs, then you do have to send the question in advance. And what's interesting is that this has led to a clash in media culture between Taiwan and international media in the past few years sometimes. Tsai, for example, did not want to go into press conferences in which she might be challenged by international media, because international media often refuses to send questions ahead of time as a point of pride, because there's often a more confrontational media culture sometimes, let's say in the UK, compared to Taiwan. And so one does see incidents like Eric Chu going to interview with Deutsche Welle, the German public broadcaster, and walking out because it doesn't go in a direction that he likes. Or, for example, Ma Ying-jeou going to interview also with Deutsche Welle and then coming out of it saying that there's a need to have faith in Xi Jinping and having electoral impact on the KMT right before the elections. And so it is a kind of question in that sense. And it does depend on what style Lai embraces. But Lai tends to like off-the-cuff comments and responding spontaneously to media. Just a question that if he will do that with international media in particular.
But of course, we can both say, Brian, that Xiaobi Kim will not shy away from press conferences.
Yeah, I mean, I think she'll be required to do that in some sense, particularly as a question of what the balance of power for dealing with international affairs between her and Lin Jialong as the foreign minister will play out to be. But then Xiao probably will take a role in the kind of diplomatic role that she has taken on to date.
And talking about the legislative UN, well, lawmakers from the KMT and the Taiwan People's Party this week confirmed they will be visiting Taiping Island in the South China Sea on May the 18th. Now, according to the itinerary provided by the legislative UN, a total of 20 lawmakers from the two parties will join the trip, and they will be led by the KMT's Ma Wen-chun, who serves as the convener of the Legislative Foreign Affairs and National Defence Committee. Now, the itinerary shows they'll be flying to Taiping Island from the Pingdong Air Force Base. They'll have their photo taken when they arrive there at a key site, at a big sign saying this is ROC territory. They'll receive an introduction to the island. They'll see Coast Guard drills, and they'll also visit the newly constructed Taiping Island Pier before heading back to Taiwan. Oh, they're also going to apparently have lunch there. That's sort of important, you know, the lunchbox is the important part of the trip. Now, the trip was meant to take place on May the 16th, but it was postponed because they're going to be busy in the Legislative UN on the 17th. Now, no DPP lawmakers registered for said trip, which has been described as an inspection tour. And DPP Legislative Caucus Secretary-General Rosella Wu earlier this week called the timing of the trip inappropriate and unwise. And she went on to claim that the trip was solely aimed at causing trouble for the government and should be postponed, as it would not be beneficial to Taiwan. So, Brian, will it be beneficial? And what's the lunchbox going to be?
Well, I don't know about the lunchbox, but it is an attempt to reinforce territorial claims of the ROC. But what is interesting is that some of these legislatures that are going to this trip have also recently traveled to China, for example, with Fu Guanqi, the KMT Legislative Caucus convener, to China. And that trip then was to reinforce this claim that KMT is the only political party in Taiwan able to communicate with the CCP, a traditional claim that's used to justify why it should be in office and not the DPP. And now here you have some of the same legislators trying to reinforce territorial claims over Taiping Island. And it's interesting because this does dovetail with China's claims over Taiping Island as based on Taiwan's claim to it, that is say the ROC's claim to it. But then it is an attempt, I think, to kind of undercut the Tsai administration or as it is heading out of office and the Lai administration as it takes office. Painting the DPP as unwilling to defend the ROC, for example, is another attempt to paint the DPP as eroding away at traditional ROC institutions. And at a time which Taiwan's diplomatic relations are strengthening with regional allies, some which also claim Itu Abla/Taiping Island, then that maybe is an attempt to throw a wrench into this strengthening diplomatic relations.
But couldn't someone from the DPP have gone? As a token person, or do you think they were told not to?
I think they were probably told not to, because the interesting thing is that the DPP is split on this issue internally. There have been past legislators from the DPP that have gone, and there are some in the DPP that actually thought this was a good idea, too, to visit Taiping Island before the end of Tsai's term. And so I think this is actually more an attempt to call the DPP legislators to fall in line. It's interesting to see the TPP also going, though, in this sense, because it is a party that's navigating the relation between the DPP and the KMT about where to position itself at present.
I don't think the time is right. And the trip could again lead to more tensions at the Legislative UN with the ruling party and draw a reaction from China. Visits to Taiping Island by past presidents have created expectations. Some might recall the Mingyu's call for peace in 2016, but the reality is totally different today. Even with major infrastructure upgrades, I think that President Tsai Ing-wen's decision reflects a careful diplomatic approach and a limited interest in the Republic of China's controversial territory. So given the U.S. criticism and the possibility of growing strains in the South China Sea, especially the global political tension and soon-to-be inauguration of President Lai, I think the timing is especially not right.
And Brian, what do you think the media will be covering this? The foreign media will be covering it bigger than the local media?
It's a good question, actually. Actually, the timing of the trip is interesting. For example, do you do this before the inauguration? Do you do this after? And it was decided to do this before, in a sense that this will then become a news story domestically and cast a bit of a shadow on the Lai inauguration. I'm sure the Lai inauguration will still see more attention unless something dramatic happens there. But it's a question. I mean, will the international media or local media be more interested in the issue? It's possible it doesn't actually get picked up on, though, ironically, by international media at all, because the Fu Guanqi trip, despite the fact that 17 lawmakers went over, was very close to one-third of the entire KMT Legislative Caucus. This was not really reported on internationally, because apparently only someone of Ma Ying-jeou's stature going to China is news. And so, strangely, some stories that are quite big in Taiwan or significant still don't get picked up on regarding cross-strait relations.
The international media is interested in the Taiping Island issue, but they look at it in the perspective of Southeast Asia issue and the relationship and the role of China in the South China Sea. Actually, we kind of tried to help international media who wanted to visit Taiping Island a couple of weeks ago, and we contacted the Ministry of Defense, but we were told that the time wasn't right, and they wouldn't even confirm that major officials, including the president, was willing to travel to Taiping Island for now. So that wasn't already impossible a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a question as to who would go, for example, because during the Fuquinsi trip to China, there were two KMT legislators that joined at the very last minute because of the fact that the proceedings in the legislature are finished early. And so there has been a initially reported list at this point of the lawmakers that intend to go over from the KMT and TPP. But it could still change because of the individual itineraries of the legislators. Who even knows? I mean, there could be a storm and
No one will go.
Exactly. And so what happens then?
And the presidential office on Tuesday refused to comment on speculation that President Tsai Ing-wen could issue a pardon for former President Chen Shui-bian before she leaves office on May the 20th. Now, according to the presidential office, the current position of the, well, presidential office is to ensure the former head of state receives adequate health care and the matter will be handled in accordance with relevant laws. Now, it came after Mirror Weekly magazine published a story in which it claimed that officials within the Tsai administration have been holding meetings to discuss pardoning Chen. Now, the story claimed that the Tsai administration could seek to confiscate any financial gains that Chen and his family netted from their criminal activities, and that the pardon not extend to suspended criminal trials in which the former president and his former staff have yet been convicted or acquitted from. Now, the KMT says Chen should only be pardoned when he admits his guilt in all crimes he committed and when all the outstanding lawsuits against him have been completed. Chen, of course, was sentenced to 20 years in prison in September of 2009 for embezzlement, bribery and money laundering while in office from 2000 to 2008. However, he was released from prison on medical parole in January of 2015 due to health problems. Now he's remained free since then, as the Taichung prison has continually extended his medical parole now, Brian, for 38 times.
Yeah, so it's a question. It comes up, I think, particularly near the end of Tsai's presidential term, because then that presents a potential window of opportunity for her to pardon him as the outgoing president. And then Lai does not have to take the controversy as much if he were the one to do that. And it's a question because it would be a political move, obviously, in order to shore up support among Chen's supporters who are more deep green and so forth. That's not necessarily the base that Lai himself needs to appeal to. He does have their loyalty in that sense, but it might be something that they would like. The other question, though, is that Chen has been making de facto political statements, appearing on radio shows and so forth, despite that being on the conditions of his parole. And so he probably become more emboldened to comment on Taiwanese politics after a parole. I mean, we see how active former presidents such as Ma Ying-jeou are, for example. And Tsai herself could be quite active after the end of her presidency. And so it's to be seen then if that sets a precedent then for former presidents becoming politically active after the end of their terms, but also in terms of the fact that all of Taiwan's presidents have faced charges after the end of their presidential terms. What happens, for example, regarding Ma or Tsai? Particularly, there have been calls, for example, for the KMT to have Tsai face charges regarding purported corruption. And so this also does set a legal precedent in case something like that were to happen, though unlikely perhaps.
Well, I understand the case against ex-president Chen, but the wider issue of corruption in Taiwan cannot be overlooked. In this sense, the possible pardon of is questionable, especially as Taiwan fights corruption at multiple levels. To some, Chen's release on medical parole, despite his corruption charges, shows inconsistencies in justice enforcement. After all, Taiwan still struggles with how to punish ongoing online and official corruption. That's the topic we mentioned earlier, those online scams, right? So I think pardoning Chen could weaken efforts to fight corruption, particularly as tougher penalties for lesser crimes are expected in Taiwan.
Of course, Brian, we could argue maybe if they pardon Chen, it could do the Lai administration more harm than good.
Yeah, it's very possible because of the fact that it's leveraged on as a partisan political act. But then regarding corruption, I mean, for example, Fuquinsi is the convener of the KMT Legislative Caucus. I mean, years in jail on corruption charges, named his wife deputy county commissioner, divorced her, then went into jail so that she become county commissioner. I mean, he is literally now such a prominent figure in the KMT. And that's even controversial within the KMT. It didn't prevent him from becoming that, taking up that position. So it shows that corruption is still very present at very high levels in Taiwanese politics. We see facing charges, for example, at present regarding his tenure as Taipei mayor.
And what do you think the general public would think? I mean, if Chen does get pardoned and he does appear at DPP-sanctioned events, do you think the public will go, oh, God, him?
I mean, it depends on which aspect of the public. But I think the deep greens will be happy. The deep blues will be very angry. And actually, it is a question to me what people in between think. Because, for example, we talked recently of how the TPP has risen as a party and attracted the swing voters and also young people. And strangely enough, I've heard Chen Shui-bian being praised at TPP political rallies along with Ma Ying-jeou. So it's kind of a question, actually. I don't know where some people feel about Chen at present.
And what about the young people? I mean, what do you think they think about him?
Well, it's funny because young people did not experience that. The ones that are in their 20s or teenagers now don't really have a memory of the Chen period, unlike, for example, me. And so in that sense, they don't have very clear views on him. And for them, maybe he's just a funny guy who posts things on Instagram, very strange memes.
This is a negotiation, I think. If they decide to grant him a pardon, they could potentially include a request that he doesn't join DPP events in the future, stay very quiet, don't start a career as an influencer in Taiwan or trying to publish and send messages to IG. So that could be maybe a give and take in this negotiation. Yes, we're going to give you a pardon, but please stay quiet in the future.
Although possibly, Brian, if they don't pardon him and he just stays out on medical parole, it could work better for everyone concerned.
It's possible. I mean, it is de facto that he is out there and doing things, but then there would be controversy if there was a pardon. And so it is a question. I think actually it's interesting to think about the precedent of pardons, though, at the end of a presidential term. There's also calls for Tsai to pardon people on death row, for example, which I think is also unlikely to happen because of the popularity of the death penalty. But it's a question that comes up, I think, for any outgoing president in Taiwan.
And business groups this week continue to call on the incoming administration of President-elect Lai Ching-te to rethink its national energy policy and revive nuclear power. Now, speaking this week at an event marking his election as chairman of the Chinese National Federation of Industries, Pan Chunrong said there are 443 nuclear power plants in operation around the world, with about 50 to 60 reactors under construction and over 100 planned. And he said the G7 nations recognise nuclear as a zero-emissions, clean and low-cost energy source. He also called on the new government to take action to address the looming power, water and labour shortages facing industries to ensure their ongoing contribution to the development of Taiwan. Now, Lai was at that event, but he really dodged the bullet questions about whether he's going to reinstate nuclear power. Now, the call did come as other leaders of business recently have been calling for the government to reopen the third and second nuclear power plants or even restart construction of the fourth nuclear power plant. Dimitri?
I understand the business interest group when they say that the nuclear power is becoming more popular and globally, and it might be time to follow this path. But it's been a very controversial issue. And it's been years for Taiwan. It was years in the meeting to shutting down those nuclear power plants. Now, ahead of the summer, and because of the recent hike in electricity price, we understand again the concern of those businesses that will have to foot the bill for, you know, those electricity bills in the summer are going to be very, very expensive. But given the time left, 2 months, it won't be enough. There won't be enough time to maybe even restart or pushing for more electricity generated by nuclear energy. With 2 months left, there isn't much left for the new government to unveil a new policy to solve these issues. So it's very likely that the new government, and on May 20, they will announce they may be looking into this issue, but I don't expect a major shift in the near future.
And I think if they're looking into it, Brian, it might take a few months, if not 4 years, for them to look into it.
Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, what's interesting is that the KMT and the DPP often trade positions on energy policy between when they're in and out of office, except for nuclear energy, you know, which the DPP is more opposed to it and the KMT is more for nuclear energy. Industry is, for example, in a period of transition. There are some companies that, for example, would prefer renewable energy sources because there's particularly pressure from the U.S. and Apple and major manufacturers that Taiwan supplies to have green supply chains, and that's a source of pressure. Nuclear is not an incredibly large part of Taiwan Taiwan's energy mix at present. So it's often a kind of political demand in the sense. But what's interesting is that there's a defense applications, because in the event of an invasion from China, nuclear would be a energy option. And that rarely comes up in the public discourse. But then I think a lot of the issues with power in Taiwan really come from energy transmission and not just use as well. And so a lot of questions about Taiwan's infrastructure and how reliable the electricity supply is for supply chains and manufacturing and et cetera, that's not just a nuclear issue. And so it is a question there. I don't expect changes in the next 2 months, though, to be sure.
My question, though, is, Brian, I mean, of course, during Ma Ying-jeou's administration, there was a huge anti-nuclear rally.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
Ma Ying-jeou was, of course, forced to act on it. But what do you think the feeling is now? Do you think if someone called for... there was a rally recently. But that was really, really small.
It's interesting because it was 427 to mark the 10-year anniversary of the 2014 anti-nuclear demonstration that took place in front of Taipei Main Station. It drew 50,000 at the time. But now, at present, with a DPP administration in power that's not so pro-nuclear, the 10-year anniversary rally drew like 100, 200 people. So it's not a lot of resistance right now because of the fact that the DPP is in power. If the KMT took power, then there might be more pushback. But actually, I think the DPP is in an interesting position where it has actually compromised on issues that historically it opposed, like, for example, U.S. Pork and beef and et cetera. So it might actually be in a position to swap positions. Even that's a very large political risk that Lai definitely would not take in his first months in office before he's consolidated any base of popularity.
Well, there is a thing with nuclear energy, because it's sometimes referred as a clean energy technology, as it produces nearly zero carbon dioxide and or other greenhouse gas emissions. So when it comes to ESGs, maybe I need to check, but maybe using more nuclear energy could maybe be part of those big semiconductor ESGs.
And before we go this week, the Center for Disease Control on Wednesday announced that it will be lifting the last vestige of its coronavirus pandemic mandates, meaning that face masks will no longer be mandatory for people visiting medical facilities such as hospitals, clinics and nursing homes. The move means people will no longer be required to wear face masks from May the 19th at such places. But the CDC is still recommending that individuals visiting medical or elderly welfare facilities do wear face masks still. Now, according to the CDC, the decision was made by an expert panel based on evidence that the coronavirus has been stable and under control in Taiwan and that pandemic control measures have been relaxed worldwide. Now, if you're interested, the mandate on wearing face masks in medical facilities and nursing homes has been in place since December the 1st of 2020, Brian, which a day of infamy.
That seems so. So it's another lifting of the coronavirus measures, but at the same time, there still continues to be high rates of mask wearing everywhere on public transport, for example, though it's not necessary. And so one does expect that in hospitals as well. And I do expect hospitals continue, for example, offering cheap masks for sale with machines outside of the hospital itself. And so I don't think it's going to change a lot. It's interesting, though, because I was sitting in a clinic when around the time this was announced, and the doctors and nurses were immediately talking about, like, oh, why? Why are they doing this? Like, this is not a good idea. So there might actually be some pushback from the medical establishment.
Yeah, well, I think this is a welcome change, and that signals progress, and it's crucial to stay alert as global health threats continue to emerge. But it's time for change. I'm not so sure about my doctors and nurses. I don't even remember seeing their faces. They've been wearing masks all their life, so I'm not sure if they will be willing to give them away, because masks still give them a sense of security.
But what about you? If you had to go to a hospital, would you still wear a mask?
Would it be like, of course,
people have to wear masks during a pandemic, but before the pandemic, when you went to hospitals, doctors and nurses wore masks, but Joe Blow public rarely wore a mask.
Well, when you enter the hospital, you might feel that you don't need to wear a mask anymore, but when you visit family, relatives and friends in hospital, you might feel that it's better for them and you to wear a mask at that time.
What about you? You're walking down a road, you twist your ankle, you got to go to hospital. Would you wear a mask or no mask?
Right now, well, if I think I would still wear a mask, definitely.
And Brian, you get hit by a bus, but you're okay. You just have to go to hospital. Wear mask or no mask?
Yeah, it's a question. I mean, I think there's enough flexibility that I don't think people are like, oh, you're not going to go in with this life-threatening injury despite not having a mask on you. I don't think that's happening at present. I think it's not as much a concern.
Well, the good thing is because people like to remind you that you should wear a mask. So now you can tell them, please, leave me alone. Again, I don't have to wear a mask anymore.
But do you still wear a mask anywhere?
Not anymore. I'm not even on public transportation.
And Brian, do you still wear a face mask anywhere?
In some contexts, yeah. I mean, for example, just some crowded places and etc.
Like subway, buses?
Depends. I think subway is usually not. But sometimes, you know, hospitals, of course, and clinics and etc. But for example, like a very crowded like post office or things like that, or someone's coughing around me in particular.
You quickly whip your mask out and put it on.
Yeah, that's
and
right.
Stare forcefully at the person who coughed.
Yeah, that's not a bad... I don't know if that's the best idea for someone that's probably feeling ill and should not be shamed for that, but yeah.
Anyway, that's where we'll leave it here this week on Taiwan This Week, and I've been joined in the studio today by Brian Yu.
Good night.
And by Dimitri Buras.
It was great to be here.
And thanks for tuning in to this week's edition of Taiwan This Week here on ICRT with me, Gavin Phipps. And don't forget to check out Taiwan This Week podcast on your favourite podcast app where you can get access to all our previous shows. And there won't be a show next week because I'll be busy doing something else, but we will return on May the 24th.
Tune in again next Friday evening at 9 for another informative look at the top stories of the week with Taiwan This Week. And don't forget to also check out our podcast on our website, icrt.com.tw. Now keep it here for more music and news only on ICRT FM 100.